listening to a special in-print broadcast featuring the book Terry Riley's In C by Robert Carl, which is part of the Studies in Musical Genesis Structure and Interpretation series published by Oxford University Press. And it's my great pleasure to have with me this afternoon Robert Carl. I'm Frank J. O'Terry, and before we plunge in, I just find it curious, this idea, it's fascinating, this idea of an entire book devoted to a single piece of music. There certainly, for a long time, have been single books, book-length studies of works of literature, like books on Ulysses or Marcel Proust's Remembrance of Things Past, which are gargantuan things. But even for standard repertoire, it's a relatively new idea to have a book that's written only about one work, maybe the last 10, 15 years or so. I'm wondering how many of these types of books you yourself have read and what kind of an impact they've had.
You know, I have to tell you that I'm woefully ignorant, I think, in this in many ways, because this book was something that I had in mind for a while, and one can talk about the why of that a little bit later, but I saw a catalog from Oxford University Press one time, and they had this series, which is essentially a musicological series dealing with monuments pretty much of the 19th century, maybe the early 20th. Very scholarly, very historically oriented, dealing with, you know, manuscripts and source material study, this sort of thing. And I just emailed the editor, whose name I saw there, Malcolm Gillies, who's actually a rather remarkable polymathic man who's a Bartok scholar, amongst many things, and said I was curious about whether this book might possibly be part of the series, even though it was a little bit of a kind of the camel's nose under the tent in terms of bringing the 20th century in. And he was really interested by that, and he said, send us a proposal. And I think it may have actually intrigued him about the idea of a piece that is recent 20th century and actually in many ways highly experimental or radical in terms of its practice that might take its place along with these repertoire monuments. So I have to say that I was more driven by the book and the topic of the book than I was driven by the genre of it.
Now, it's fascinating that there hasn't yet in that series been a single work by an American composer. You'd think there'd be a book maybe on Charles Ives's Fourth Symphony or Sonatas and Interludes of Cage. I mean, the name two that jump out at me. I know that there's a book by Kyle Gann that's in the pipeline coming out Yale University Press on 433.
I've actually read the proofs. I'm one of the blurbers for it, so I've read it. In many ways, it's, I think, a somewhat similar book in spirit to mine, because though dealing with 433, he really enlarges the scope to make it a portrait of Cage at the in the years leading up to it. So,
well, I wonder, as long as we're talking about pieces, what, not every piece could really benefit from a whole book-length study. Not every piece has that much extraneous history around it, let's say.
Right.
I mean, what are some of the other pieces that immediately pop to mind that such a book could happen around? It's sort of a loaded question.
Well, if you want to think about earlier in the 20th century, a piece like, either Rite of Spring or Pierrot, I think, would, because they were revolutionary works and landmark works. You've mentioned a few right there. I mean, I am not an Ives scholar, but I certainly I feel enormously touched and influenced by Ives' music. I could see easily a work on the Fourth Symphony, though it sends out so many tentacles to so many other pieces, it would immediately create a web of relationships with some other important pieces from the decade that he wrote it.
So ideally, a book like this, it's different than, say, a book that was on Terry Riley exclusively, or a book on minimalism. It really is a very specific window into something.
Yes, it's true, though I will say that the book, and I should say, if someone hasn't seen it, it's not a big book. It's about 160 pages. But it is, to some degree, a portrait or a bio of Terry leading up to NC. So in a sense, it's maybe the first half of his life. When I first met him, he did say, well, I haven't had a biography yet, and maybe this is it. I hope it isn't. I hope there's more coming in the pipeline. But it serves a certain function of taking him up to about, I would say, 1968, 69. It does also deal with the pieces that led up to NC. So starting from, you know, works that he was writing just after he got to San Francisco and to Berkeley, the string quartet, the trio, Music for the Gift, which he made in Paris, the pieces that are both acoustic, classical, quote-unquote, and the pieces that are electroacoustic, and then all the various other influences of jazz and drug use and the sort of culture which was in between beat and counterculture in San Francisco at the time. All of those things go into the mix and are absolutely, I think, is sort of essential to show how you got to a certain critical point where he wrote the piece and essentially, you know, one night in a white heat, it really does seem to be. That's one of those apocryphal stories that seems to be true. At least the horse's mouth says it is, and I believe him.
Now, what's so interesting with Terry saying, you know, maybe this will be his biography, of so many composers, you know, we often talk about composers and works they're associated with. You mentioned Stravinsky and Rite of Spring, and certainly you had a very, very long career, but Rite of Spring is the piece that everyone thinks of.
Yeah.
Schoenberg-Pierrot, maybe less so. I mean, I think people think of Reclair Tonnach, they think of a few other pieces. Terry Riley in NC, it's almost indelible. There's no other piece he's done that has had quite the impact of that. And it's sad considering all the amazing solo piano pieces he's written, the string quartets, one of the most prolific composers of string quartets of our lifetime. And yet this piece is like all the way over here where everything else is just sort of hasn't jumped out of the pack, so to speak. So, you know, why do you think that is?
Well, I think for one thing, it met a particular need with genius at the moment, which was to work out a strategy for dealing with open form that still preserved character and a certain precision and yet also was so incredibly open. And I think the balancing act that he got doing that with the piece and with the structure of the piece, the one score, the 53 modules, one-page score, is, first of all, just a remarkable thing. And he himself says that, you know, he could have gone on and done it over and over again, and he really decided not to. There are only a couple of pieces that follow that are anything like this, Tread the Trail and Autumn Leaves. And then after that, he pretty much put it aside. So anyway, I think that to begin with, there's no other piece like it in his repertoire because he made the decision not to do, and also that it stands out because it seems to meet a very particular need for this basically structure and improvised musics melding together. And, you know, it's I would say, too, one thing about it that I've discovered over listening to a lot of the pieces, a lot of the recordings that have been made over the years, is that there are few pieces that are as welcoming to musicians that come from an unbelievable range of experiences, not just quote-unquote classical versus non-classical, but Western, non-Western, you know, popular and learned, whatever that is. All of these points on the spectrum, they seem to be able to find a meeting point in the piece. And in that sense, I think it's one of the most benign form of globalization that you can possibly have, and is a countermodel to the ways that that has gone in a lot of ways. I think it's a nice thing.
Now, you mentioned these other two pieces, which are barely known at all, and I'm thinking of a third piece that sort of falls into Olsen 3 also.
Yeah,
you know, that all of those fall in there, but none of those pieces caught on. There, you know, there's one recording of Olsen 3, this like historic reissue recording on Organ of Corti. There isn't this kind of wellspring the way there is with NC. And I'm wondering if, to some extent, it's because of how widely available the score of NC is. Mm-hmm. The fact that it's on one page, the fact that he's, with Terry's permission, it appears on several websites, so it's very easy to download.
Right.
It's one page. Everyone has the same part.
Right.
There's something extremely practical aside from all the stuff we're talking about philosophically, you know, how it brings people together, how it represents all these things, but just the sheer practicality of it being a one-page score that anyone with a personal computer and an internet connection and a printer could just press play and have.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I couldn't agree more. I think that Terry, well, first of all, it's one of those things where it was an incredibly courageous decision to print the score on the fold-out of the original LP. Because, you know, you bought the LP, it was one of those, you know, it had a fold-out of the front cover, and there it was white on black on top of it. Very 60s that way. And so everybody got the score when they bought the recording. And it immediately became clear how it worked, too. There was no mystification about what the technique or the process was. You can figure it out, you know, in a second. So that was enormously courageous. But at the same time, it was prescient because it's like freeware, right? You know, free is the new economy. Well, there he did that. And I think no thing was more important to his career than that giving away that he did. And I mean to the practical professional aspects of his career. So so I think, yeah, it's had an enormous impact on why that piece is what it is in the canon, why it's iconic.
And in terms of contemporary music compositions, I can't think of any that have been recorded mm-hmm. as many times, different times, you know, different interpretations, the way we think of different interpretations, say, of a Beethoven symphony.
Right.
Or, you know, a Mozart opera.
Yeah.
Where there are all these different choices to choose from. Within C, there are all these choices to choose from.
Yeah. Now, there's one interesting thing, because I think there's a subtle but a real difference between the repertoire and in C, because since NC is open instrumentation and duration is open, and as a consequence, because of that kind of accordion structure that it has where it can expand or contract, the relationships between the modules are also different from performance to performance, even though the sequence always remains the same. The general topography of it does always remain the same. I guess because of that, every time someone decides to perform it, every time someone's recorded it, it also is a new piece. It's always a new version. It's a new realization. And maybe we should be using the word realization instead of interpretation for it, because interpretation suggests the 19th century ideal and before of there being a score, which is a fixed artifact, which one realizes as close as possible to the text. NC is really, you can get only so close, and then like a magnetic field, you bounce off it in terms of trying to get too close or too pure, I think.
Now, one of the things I find so wonderful about your book is you have this elaborate annotated discography at the very end of the book that talks about every different version there is of NC. Now, there are people for whom minimalism is not necessarily the style they're drawn to, who, mm-hmm. who find constant repetition to be a thing that's maybe even a source of irritation. So to listen to one recording would be a challenge for such a person, but to listen to like 12 different recordings of it, and I would imagine many times over to get the kind of detail that you bring to this. So I'd be interested in hearing your process of the time that you spent with all of these recordings and what that was about.
Well, what's interesting, it's a learning process. And indeed, eventually, you know, what I have, and there's a much prettier realization of it in the book than what I was working from, which were the raw sheets, is I would just work up this template, which showed a time grid going from left to right and from top to bottom, the modules. And then I would just listen and figure out when each module entered and exited. And so there's this series of horizontal bars that are moving their way from left to right across the page and slowly descending all with the different types of overlaps. And so I would do that actually with each one. And the interesting thing is over time, I got better at it. And so it didn't take so long. I mean, the first one I did is the one that's in the book, which is, of course, the 1968 premiere recording. And by the way, I am sure that someone else will listen and will hear differences with what I hear, because for one thing, many of the modules are deliberately close to one another. And if you are hearing one ending, you may actually be fooled because it's the beginning of another one that's very, very closely structured. You know, this is one of those things where you try to make the best judgment call you can. But the other answer to your question is that, strangely enough, precisely because of the difference between the spirit of the different recordings, it almost becomes this adventure of, like, what next? What's it going to be now? I mean, there's this one Russian recording with a group that's called the Terry Riley Repetition Orchestra. I'm sure it's not a typo. I think it's a joke. And it's a group, it's a performance from Moscow, and they're like these, you know, women kind of yodeling and sleigh bells, and I mean it's like Lenos gone wild. And yet it's the piece. You hear everything in it.
Now, I often joke with people about, you know, the critics in Gramophone magazine who compare the tempo markings and the changes in tempo of different conductors' interpretations of Bruckner symphonies, and
right.
you know, say, you know, that, you know, this conductor did that, Joachim yeah. did this, and
well, you know, and indeed, this is Oxford Press, so I do say what the tempo is. I mean, it's very easy, you know, you just have your metronome with you and just listen to the pulse very carefully and adjust it until you've got the light flashing with it. And so it's there, that's there for the documentation. And, you know, since the book has come out, two more recordings have come out of it. So, I mean, it means there has to be another edition, I guess. That's my hope, so I can try to keep up with them.
Now, one of the things that just came out is this unusual two-disc yeah. set of remixes on
right.
Innova, which kind of takes this notion of malleability to an even further extreme, this
right.
idea of realization,
yeah.
you said, rather than performance. Because certainly, yeah, they were working with mm-hmm. a performance of In C by this wonderful
the Grand Valley
group,
State
the Grand
group,
Valley. Yeah. And, but then all these composers and DJs remixed the mm-hmm. piece and created their own realizations, some of which are very, very different
yeah.
in sound, but all of which have a hint
right, exactly.
of what In C is. So what might a process like that be in terms of creating a future trajectory for this
well,
piece?
Well, it's an interesting thing. I mean, Terry is very open to whatever people do. I mean, he's very generous, and he's, I think, inherently curious, and I don't think he has any trouble with it. I've listened once through the whole set, and I think actually the works that appeal to me the most are in fact the ones that are so different that they stand on their own as pieces. When you listen to the performance of NC that the group gives, which is a great one, it's very tight. It's one of the shortest ones around, actually. The piece still stands, you know, as I hate to use this sort of work because it's so counterculture, but it still has this, you know, quality of being a monument, which I think is wonderful. Many of the other pieces strike to me is that they're homages. You know, it's like the Tombeau de Terry that we have here, and I mean, I can just tell you that there were two that I was particularly taken by. One was Mason Bates, where, you know, he just really turned it in. There are a couple more that make it purely into like a sort of club mix that you will dance to, and I think that's maybe one of the hopes that they have for the album that'll go out there in the world and do that, like the Reich remix album. But the Mason Bates, you know, had a really interesting mix, I thought, between the original sounds and the techno sounds. And then David Lang's that just went completely, you know, somewhere else. It just processed enormously and turned into this big, slowly mutating electroacoustic texture. And, you know, in a way, it's almost like, you know, it's like the ghost of the piece sort of floating along there. And so for me, I guess I like the works that take off from it and actually make truly new pieces. But that's partly just my taste there.
David Lang said something very interesting. He said this publicly a number of times, that for him and for composers of his generation, In C represents the kind of life-changing work for all composers that the Rite of Spring used to represent mm-hmm. for composers.
You know, it occupies a similar position in the birth of a movement. You know, you look at Paris in 1913, you can say, well, there's modernism for you. That's where it starts. It's easy to make it as a breakpoint, even though there are a million things that presage it and that, you know, you could choose other important strands. Same thing with minimalism. But I think that NC really is just such an obvious encapsulation of everything that's going on. And, you know, the one thing about it is that
everything that's in C was already in the air, but it is the first piece to bring, I guess I'm thinking, slow harmonic motion, pulse and repetition, and actually, and modal harmonic structure, put all of those elements together in one piece. All of those were already out in the air, but not combined as fully and successfully as I think NC does. So in that sense, you know, it is the Rite of Spring of a movement that sort of changed the shape. I would say one other thing, too, is that, you know, a lot of early minimalism was extremely purist, you know, very strict, rigorous, and abstract. And I feel like, you know, the early Reich phasing pieces, enormously different from the sound of modernist music that actually, I think, sharing a certain sort of rigorous abstraction that is tied to modernism. One thing about NC, I think, also is that it is one of the first pieces that sort of sounds more like both popular music and world music, especially world music. Rock wasn't so much, I think, in Terry's mind at the time. It was much more jazz, the sort of jazz and world music, jazz and Indian music in particular. So it's opening up to other types of music in the world, and it's also, I think, just much more playful, and that playfulness of it also makes it a kind of postmodern thing, as well as minimalist. And I think that's maybe another aspect of the influence that there's going along there.
Now, what's so interesting is you say he didn't have rock music in mind, but certainly so many rock groups have done the piece.
Oh, and sure.
Even, you know, there was and even early on, there was a rock band named Curved Air after a rainbow.
Yeah, right.
Curved Air.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, I was part of some of the performances that the Styrenes did.
Oh, are you really? I love that
Not the recording.
Okay.
But they did a live tour after it, and I
Lucky duck.
I know, it was amazing. But what was the most amazing thing about it, perhaps, was we played at this club in Brooklyn, and these young girls came up to us after the end of it and said, "We really love your music. That was the most amazing piece." I said, "Well, it's actually not our music. It's from 1964, and their jaws dropped. They had no comprehension that this thing had been around, and this was a few years back, so, you know, 40 years.
Right, yeah.
At the time.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, you know, it's just that it was, as usual, ahead of the curve, I think, in a lot of ways, because what was going to happen in San Francisco was, you know, it was starting to emerge there. You know, stuff was going on at the Fillmore, you know, Tony Martin, who did the light show for NC, was to go on and become, you know, actually quite well known doing light shows at the Fillmore, even though he does not want to be recognized as that's the be all and end all of his life, as I understand completely. But still, it was more like a prophecy, I think, than it was reflecting the times.
Well, in terms of people who were involved with it, that's another thing about the catalyst that it represented. Mm. So many composers, you mentioned Steve Reich. Steve Reich was part of that first performance of NC. And really hadn't done those phase pieces yet. Those happened after. You know, It's Gonna Rain is 1965. That's a year later.
Right.
And, you know, Pauline Oliveros was involved. Mort Subotnick, whose music was very different, but he was part of that first performance. And later on, certainly for the first recording, Stuart Dempster, John mm-hmm. Hassell, David Rosenboom, Katrina Krimsky, you know, all of these like major figures of the last, you know, 45 years. And then people were involved who were very important then, who perhaps should be better known now. People like, you know, Ramon Sender, John Gibson, Phil mm-hmm. Windsor, but a really heady group of people. Yeah. These weren't just sidemen.
No, no. I mean, it was, for one thing, Terry, I think, inspires a certain loyalty to begin with. He's very generous and people reciprocate. It sort of comes. And so when the concert in 1964 was organized, which was a retrospective, and they were doing that year at the San Francisco Tape Music Center, it was going to be a series of local artists, each with their own show. And for Terry's show, he actually wrote NC for it. And then he just was sort of calling people in, you know, calling them up, getting people off the street. There's one man who's a jazz pianist named James Lowe who played in it, who basically was working at the Tate Music Center in a barter arrangement where I think he did, you know, managerial, custodial type work, and then they gave him access to the machines and he was like hanging around and Terry said, "Come on and play in my piece." So there was that sort of thing. Actually, Reich says that at the dress rehearsal, a couple of hippies came in with a trumpet and tried to start playing, and Reich was the one who threw them out. Terry probably would have let them play. So anyway, it's like, I just want to blow, man. but anyway, I know I'm getting a little off the point. The group was there, I think, because you know they enjoyed the communal experiences that they'd had in a lot of different ways. They'd been together for a while, you know. People like, you know, Pauline Oliveros and Morton Subotnick and Terry had all been in grad school together. There was other people he'd been working with other folks at the Tate Music Center. So I think that it was just a good chance to actually do a kind of community action. They sort of expressed their bonding by doing it. And the thing that was great about it, aside from just the fact that it birthed a piece, was that there was, in particular, Stuart Dempster there, who, interestingly enough, did not play the premiere. He may have played the second of the two performances, but he had another gig. When I wrote the book, I interviewed him, he couldn't believe he didn't do it, but then he went back and he looked at his books because he's meticulously documented his life beautifully. And in fact, he said, gosh, I had a gig with the Oakland Symphony that night. I couldn't have played. I had to come. I knew I heard it. But anyway, he heard it. He played in a revival concert that happened maybe about half a year later, just before Terry left to go to Europe. Which actually didn't happen. He ended up going to New York. But he knew the piece. He had the score. And when he got to Buffalo for the Creative Associates program, he was the one who said, we should do this piece, and brought it to the attention of Lucas Voss. And that led to first some sort of recital-type performances in Buffalo. Then it was taken up and taken to New York. David Behrman had been brought into the mix, so to speak, as a listener. He liked the piece, and he went back to Columbia and said, we should really record this piece, and one thing led to another. And I do think that the piece, one thing that is very interesting about it as a new model in the 20th century is that it's a piece that had two premieres, because the concert premiere was certainly, you know, incredibly important, and especially as an event. Historically, we look back on it. But if it had only been that, you know, this piece might not be the piece that it became. It was the fact that it had the recording that came out in 1968 by a major label that was looking, that amazingly enough thought that they would actually have crossover appeal going in both directions to both classical and a more sort of counterculture youth audience, and that they were looking for things that might fit that mold. And that's something that I'm not sure has ever happened before.
The other thing that I find so interesting about the piece, just in terms of the open formness of it and Terry's openness, mm-hmm. is that the pulse wasn't part of the original conception of the piece. And the addition of the pulse, it's sort of like you read about Ezra Pound's role in editing The Wasteland, and how, you know, in a way, you know, The Wasteland wouldn't be what it was if Pound hadn't mm-hmm. edited Elliot.
Right.
And the same thing is sort of true for In C and The Pulse.
Yeah, and this is where Steve Reich comes into play, because he was part of the ensemble, and in the rehearsals, of which there were not many, by the way. No one knows exactly how many there were. No one really remembers, but it was very informal. And probably as late as more or less the dress rehearsal, they were sort of floundering around. They couldn't quite keep together. And Reich says, well, once a drummer, always a drummer. And he said, let's have a pulse. And they didn't have a trap set, so they put it on the piano. And they had Reich's girlfriend at the time, Jeannie Brecken, I believe, doing it. So there was, you know, it's very interesting. It's almost like there's the work. It's signed by Terry Riley, but there is a Steve Reich thumbprint on it in the pulse there. It probably would have been much more like Music for the Gift, which is the electroacoustic piece that precedes it. Much more sort of big amorphous cycles, I think it would have felt like. It wouldn't have had quite the precision that it had. But again, Terry, you know, one of the things that he has, I think, a gift for is that, you know, he says, hey, that's a good idea. Let's do that. And it's not, you know, appropriative or defensive about where something comes from. It just works. And so I think that that's, that's part of the collaborative process right there.
Now, in terms of the story of all these composers, one of the stories that I find so fascinating is you have this little story in the book about the man who walked out of NC, the composer, mm-hmm. Henry Jacobs. Mm-hmm. And I was so intrigued by that that I looked up Henry Jacobs. I was hoping that you'd have an interview with him in the book.
Yeah.
You know, and where that
I don't think
came.
He's alive anymore, I think.
Really? Okay, because I looked on the web and I found a website mm-hmm. that purports to have contact information for him. Maybe this hasn't been updated in a while. There's a recording. He was involved with Ken Nordine. He created all this whacked out music, Vortex sound experiments.
Right, right.
And I thought, okay, this guy's a nut job. Why is he having a problem with NC? And this guy sounds like the kind of guy who would have loved to have been part of this.
You know, it's very interesting, too. Somebody who's a graduate student at Berkeley had emailed me about this, too. I think he's doing a dissertation on Henry Jacobs. And, you know, I wrote back to him and said, well, this is what I have from participants. And I think that I don't know. I didn't interview him. I'm not sure if he's still alive or not. And so, you know, if he is and he hears this, please let me know and don't be too angry with me. I think that probably there was, well, you know, now and then it's like when you have a dueling Marxist sects, where there are people who are doing a certain type of experimental thing, which is really their world, and they feel that that's really where it needs to be going. And I could see that, you know, if he was doing very sort of whacked out electroacoustic music, I think he had like a series at the Exploratorium in the San Francisco Science Center that he was doing this, and it may have been much more, I could see, my imagination is, and it really is only that, it could be a little bit like a kind of American version of the INAGRM series in France, you know, it was this very sort of, but maybe very surrealistic and San Francisco inflected music concrete. Well, I mean, in that sense, this music, which was probably sounded so relatively simplistic, if you were really involved with complex electroacoustic layering and textures and stuff like that, might have had markers about it that set off the wrong alarm bells. I mean, but it really is a guess, you know. I don't want to malign someone without knowing, you know, what the truth is on that.
Well, I want to try to track him down. Well, you've inspired me.
Yeah, yeah. Please do, and please let me know.
And all of this brings me to talking about, you know, you talk about this book. I mean, you're sort of a backdoor historian, as it were. You're a composer.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, that's primarily what you do, is you write music. And I find it interesting, as long as we're talking about these rival aesthetics, because your own music is worlds away.
Yeah,
from NC. It's fascinating. I have the disc on Innova, the disc on New World. Mm-hmm. Wonderful music, violin sonatas.
Yeah, yeah.
Very, very deep, moving, profound piece of music, I think. And there's a percussion ensemble on the Innova disc that I really like. But it's very, very different.
Sure.
It's not. It has nothing to do with minimalism. I mean, maybe there are some surface analogies, but there, mm-hmm. there it ends. So
why?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, part of it is that it's hard for me not to like a new piece of music. I mean, I can be disappointed, sure, you know, but it's always, number one, it's always a thrill for me. That's the most facile answer. I'll get more substantial from there. Number two, both doing, because another thing I do is, you know, I write a lot of reviews for Fanfare of, you know, new music CDs. And I kept hearing recordings of NC, and my whole idea of it changed as I heard more and more realizations. And I realized what a remarkably flexible, open, adaptable piece it is. And it seemed to me more and more to be something. And by the way, I will say, in terms of my own music, I've got a lot of pieces, and I have a whole category of pieces that are more open form and improvisational and so forth. So, and I think that this aspect of 21st century music practice is only going to get more and more important. You know, the lines between what's called, you know, jazz and classical are, you know, melting as we speak. And I think that what NC represents is one of many useful models for ways of dealing with that greater interpenetration between different traditions. The other thing is my students. So I'm teaching these young composers, you know, well, they just take this for granted, number one. The piece it's, you know, it's a landmark, it's an icon, you know, it's a masterpiece, fine. They are also, in terms of these quote-unquote young, let's call them classical composers for lack of a better word, they're really much more open to and using improvisation and structuring improvisation than previous generations. They see it as, they see it actually as part of their craft. And I think for me as a composer teaching composition, that led me to think more and more about the importance of this piece and why I wanted to study with it. And I feel like I've learned an enormous amount. I would say one thing is that over time, even though, sure, you're right, my music is very different from what would be called minimalist or post-minimalist. You know, if there's any tradition, I feel it's probably in a more kind of early American ultra-modernist, you know, with Ives and Ruggles and some romantic elements thrown in. But the idea of pacing, the idea of space, the idea of allowing music to open up and take as long as is necessary to do what it needs to do, that's a thing that I've learned from minimalism. Just as I learned from Cage to stop being afraid. You know, Cage is like the ultimate model of just give up your fear and just do what needs to be done and, you know, and follow your imagination. I mean, you know, there's a composer who in one sense I have no relationship in my own music with in any sort of technical way, but is an enormous inspiration to me. So
now it's interesting that you say, you know, you're always open to a new piece of music. And in a way, it's not such a new piece of music. I mean, you were 10 years old when in C.
Oh, and I'm speaking in general right now about just anything that I encounter that is presented as a new piece. You're right. This is, but I was, I will say that I was, I'm trying to think. I probably first heard it maybe about 74. So that's not too long, you know, after the maybe 6 years after the disc came out. And I remember when I first heard it, it was a kind of disorienting experience for me because, you know, I was, in fact, a late starter as a composer, and I was just getting involved in writing music at all. I was in college. And I was very drawn, certainly the music of Ives. I was actually, and still am, very, I find Carter's music very important to me. And so this was almost like a challenge or almost an insult. And I think I was kind of scared of it at first. Though I also think that first recording, fantastic as it is, defined the piece a little too clearly in people's ears. It was much more of a kind of carnival when you listen to it and you didn't hear the structure as well. It's not like because you hear the structure that's better, but you know, there are many different aspects to it and the multiplicity of it, it got frozen in amber for a while because of that recording. That was the devil's bargain. That was the trade-off. So, you know, I heard it early on, but frankly, it took me a long time to grow up to where I could, I think, really appreciate it enough to have something maybe useful to say about it. And that I hope shows a love of the piece, because I will say, you know, I listen to it now, and, you know, after years of hearing all these different performances, I know when this or that module is coming up, and when, you know, like, when module 35 hits with the long melody, it's just like this, you know, I get a rush, and I'm going to say, okay, how are they going to deal with it now? Just, I know that's kind of insider, but it's one of those works that, like any great piece of music, eventually you kind of know it, you know the sequence, and you know the tunes, you know the progressions, and in that sense, I can't imagine being disappointed by it as a piece. I might be disappointed by some performance, though in a way it would have to be in some way really bad. That's another thing about it. It's almost indestructible, it seems. You'd have to be a really bad performance for you to, for NC to be significantly maimed. You know, it could be left kind of anodyne, but not really destroyed.
I think what's so interesting, you know, just sort of talking about that coming to this piece, you're coming out of an Ives, Carter,
yeah.
You know, Ruggles trajectory, is seeing this sort of continuum of, you know, the shorthand is the Maverick tradition.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is yet another manifestation of it. And you talked about, you know, Reich's early process pieces being kind of, you know, modernist in spirit, if not in sound. And I think maybe now that we're in the 21st century, we can look back on this 20th century, all of it,
right,
in all sides of it, And now even C to the point, to rehash those terms uptown and downtown, which seem